ago. An off-duty security guard was arrested early Wednesday after allegedly shooting and killing an aggressive panhandler, San Francisco police said. And that was on July 6th. Shooting occurred in front of 415 Taylor Street shortly before 2:30 a.m. Police said Scott Fredette, 31, and a 50-year-old tourist from Carmel just emerged from the Hotel Californian when they were approached by an unidentified man. The security guard at the Nob Hill Hotel and his companion told the officers that the man asked for money and continued after Fredette told them to leave them alone. When the panhandler continued to harass them and became threatening, Fredette told investigators he pulled out his revolver and fired 4 shots at the man. Police also interviewed other witnesses who told them that the dead man was neither panhandling nor acting aggressively before the shooting. Fredette fled after the shooting and the tourist returned to the Hotel Californian where he was staying. The wounded man was taken to San Francisco General Hospital where he was pronounced dead with gunshot wounds to the head and upper chest. He was not identified pending notification of his family. Police later arrested Fredette in his Sutter Street apartment. He was booked for investigation of murder. Police secured the apartment while they sought a search warrant. Well, I guess that's better than the whole thing being ignored, though I haven't heard much further media coverage of the story. The rule in San Francisco seems to be ask for a spare change, go to the morgue. And then on the other hand, we have a story from around the same time, also in the Examiner, 3 days later. No, that's the same day, on the 6th. ATM stab victim yet unidentified. Authorities have been unable to identify a man who was stabbed to death after using a Tenderloin ATM machine by an assailant who was apparently demanding money. The coroner is trying to identify the victim, an Asian man believed to be in his 50s, who was stabbed to death near Larkin and Myrtle Streets Monday. Although investigators have an identification card that they believe belongs to the victim, they have been unable to find any next of kin to confirm his identity. Minutes after the killing, police arrested Paul E. Jefferson, 35, and booked him into the San Francisco County Jail on suspicion of murder, armed robbery. Witnesses told police that minutes before he was killed, the victim had used a bank ATM at Polk Street and Golden Gate Avenue, then walked north. Jefferson was seen near the ATM and apparently followed the victim. At Larkin and Myrtle Streets, Jefferson confronted the victim and loudly demanded money. Witnesses told police the victim said, "Leave me alone," and tried to walk away, Hendricks said. The rebuffed Jefferson knocked the victim to the ground, hit him several times, and then began stabbing him, witnesses told police. Some witnesses thought he was hitting him, but actually he was stabbing him. Other witnesses saw the blade, Hendricks said. Jefferson apparently took the wallet, put it in his pocket, and fled, Hendricks said, but he returned only a couple of minutes later, stabbed the wounded man a few more times, and began searching through the victim's clothing, he said. By this time, a crowd had gathered, and one witness kicked the assailant as he leaned over the victim. Jefferson then allegedly brandished a knife and started to run. Several people, including a tourist from Italy, ran after the assailant, shouting. The onlookers then flagged down Fire Battalion Chief David McCarroll, who was passing by in his department car. As he chased the assailant in his car, he radioed for police, who arrested Jefferson a block away on Cedar Street. Jefferson admitted to taking $2 from the victim, but denied stabbing him, Hendricks said. A bloody knife was found in his clothing, and he was covered with blood. There was blood all over his pants and shoes. Hendricks believes that Jefferson took the wallet and then realized that the victim put the ATM cash in his pocket, not his wallet. That would explain why he returned, Hendricks said. Jefferson, who told police he was a homeless crack user, has been in and out of prison since 1983. According to the State Department of Corrections, he most recently served a 4-year term for possession and purchase of cocaine for sale in Sonoma County, went to prison in May 1989, was paroled in March 1991, but was sent back 4 times for parole violations. He was released from parole last March. He was also sentenced to 3 years in prison in November 1986 for burglary, also in Sonoma County. Before that, he received terms for burglary and receiving stolen property. Hendricks and his partner, Earl Sanders, are asking any witnesses to call and so forth and so on. Coroner's still looking for identification. And that's the case of a man killed allegedly for $2 at an ATM machine. It seems like he must have gotten more out of the ATM machine than $2. Panhandlers are getting shot. ATM users are getting stabbed. That's in beautiful San Francisco. Here in Santa Cruz, I saw some panhandling yesterday. Some of the hosts, the local folks who walk up and down in their green shirts, making sure that the street is free of criminal sitters, wandering dogs, even on leashes, and panhandlers, were themselves panhandled. we had a little impromptu host watch squad that began watching these hosts to kind of keep tabs on them and see what they were doing. And one host walked by and was actually asked for spare change, and he declined to give them some, so we naturally decided to make sure that real hospitality was provided and provided the indigent person with a couple of coins to keep the sun shining. But I would like to point out that the host did not call the police at that point that we saw, nor castigate the panhandler for asking for spare change on Pacific. This was around Cathcart and Pacific, actually, and it happened yesterday, Sunday afternoon, beautiful day. So I usually give the hosts a bad rap, and I don't believe the hosts have a legitimate function at this time, given their major eyes and ears of the police function, given the fact that there's no real input from the poor street homeless youth community to them in terms of their policy, given the fact that they're trained and run by First Alarm and according to their own report, the police department. Still, I'm glad to hear that the more moderate and reasonable they get, the happier I get. And I'd like to keep hearing reports on what's going on with them, positive and negative, to keep you informed so you can hear what seems to be happening downtown on the Mall, which is unfortunately becoming more of a mall and less of a Pacific Garden. It hasn't been a Pacific Garden for some time, actually, but there was a lot of beauty there yesterday, a lot of laid-back quality, a lot of folks sprawling around, sitting illegally, and not just at Cathcart and Pacific. Perhaps the host saw the two of us, the host watcher squad, behind him, and that's why he didn't tell the four young people that were sitting at the corner of Lincoln and Pacific, the same corner where Eric Marcus was accosted by a host, arrested by an officer, thrown into jail, and finally fined $100 for sitting there at the beginning of the year. Isn't happening now maybe so much, or at least it wasn't happening yesterday. If it does happen, I'd like to hear about it. And the number to call if it happens to you during the week or it happens to someone you know is 423-HUFF, 423-4833, which is HUFF is an acronym for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. I'm not homeless, but I know plenty of people who are, and we're concerned with the rights and civil liberties of everybody on the streets, and particularly as that pertains to poor people and people who the police and the community perceive as poor or alternative culture, and so on occasion go out of their way to harass and trouble. The number for you to call now, however, if you have a comment to make, whether it's about nicknames or ATM victims or anything that concerns realities of life on the streets here in Santa Cruz, give a call to 427-3772. And I see our phone's ringing now. I hope that we have a more serious caller than before.
Hi there, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hi there.
Hi there.
I'm always serious.
I think I recognize this voice.
I don't care.
Okay, well, would you like to sign in?
Sign in. No.
Okay.
But you can sign me in.
I will assign you a name. Yeah, this sounds like Linda, Lighthouse Linda LeMaster.
Okay, good guess. Mm-hmm. But I have two short comments.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, Robert, I think this is personal. I think you would be wise to share the fact that you, in fact, have been homeless in this city.
Mm-hmm.
Most people like to think of you in...
That's true, I have.
In more than once and in different areas, including
mm-hmm.
the downtown.
Yeah, I've been homeless for at least a year in the last 8 years, but homeless to some extent by choice.
Well, I think the more homeless you are, the more important it is to think you have some choice in your life.
I mean, these laws do affect me, though, because I have been harassed by them on the streets, and I think all of us have a legitimate concern. You can not be homeless, and the police perceive you as that, or as being of a class that they think should not
yeah.
be downtown or should be acting differently than the rest of the people or, you know, provide less economic value.
I think that's one of the two important points I wanted to make, that, you know, these judgments aren't being made about just how people happen to look. You know, if you happen to wear a tie-dye shirt or you don't look like you got your clothes ironed, you might have slept in them, you're treated like you're from a certain class of people. It's total looksism.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, people who are totally homeless and probably break the law every night might look like they just came in from Congress.
All right. In fact, that's the best way to look if you're homeless.
And when I'm homeless, I do my damnedest to have unrunny nylons on, and when I'm not homeless, I could give a damn about such a thing.
Good point.
You know, just for an example. And I had a second point. You brought up the host program, and again, you sort of, pardon me, but you sort of a mealy-mouth qualification of whether you support it or don't support it.
Oh, no, I don't support it.
You sounded like an apologist.
No, I was saying that I had some positive experiences yesterday, and I... But I also said that I didn't support the program. I think they're the eyes and ears of the police and supporting bad laws.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I appreciated it when Kim first picked up on the fact that that was the way they were being sold and contrived as the eyes and ears of the police in order to get funding from the merchants to get them. But what I would like to say is, you know, I think they can do an important thing perhaps in town, but calling them a host, that's a fraud. And I'm aiming this criticism not at those people who have to get the jobs and walk up and down and labeled costumes on the mall, trying to maintain a certain decorum and sort of a prisoner military order, but whoever named them hosts, probably the city, perhaps the merchants too. They're not hosts. Hosts would be handing out candy bars or something. They would not be telling you where you can and can't sit. And their attitude certainly doesn't reflect any host or hostessing. And we could have hosts. So as long as they're called hosts, there's a fraud going on. There's a deceitful, I think, snide attitude. You know, they should be called safety patrols or security guards or control forces or something a little more honest.
Obergruppenführers, perhaps?
What?
No, that would be wrong.
Well, I don't want to go the other extreme either, you know.
Actually, the program was named, I think, the program is named different things in different cities, but comes primarily from the same... Get rid of the panhandlers, get rid of the poor people while you're pretending to help everybody out program, which it's called the Guides in Berkeley, and I think it's called the Greeters in Santa Barbara, and maybe called other things in Arcata. And it was, I think the name was coined by Catherine Byers. I could be wrong about that, but I think she either called it the Hosts or the Hospitality Program.
Oh, yeah.
And it's interesting that she and Celia Scott, the two most supposedly liberal members of the city council, sit on the board of the Downtown Management Corporation, which is the corporation formed to manage the hosts. And I was pointing out last Friday, and I want to remind the audience and tell you too, as a member of the audience, that there is a meeting of the board of directors of the Downtown Management Corporation who controls the hosts and funds them and directs them on Thursday, 3 days hence, at, I think it's 8:15 or 8:30, I'm not quite sure which. Show up early if you want to be sure. And it's at the Downtown Association offices, which I believe are 1347 Pacific. It's right under Paper Visions or thereabouts, and or right next to Paper Visions. It's right across from the Palomar and the Coffee Roasting Company. And if you're interested, you know, show up down there in the morning and see what these hosties are doing. I don't think they're giving away cupcakes and...
see what they're doing on the sidewalks. What we need to do is communicate to these people.
That's
what
I mean.
Paying them what they're doing.
That's what I mean. Speak about what your experiences are with what they're doing. I think that's a very valuable thing to do. And
I'd like to say I wish there were hosts. I wish there were marquees like in an indoor shopping mall that show you where to find what. I think our city could be much, much, much more hospitable. And since the claim is that tourism is the primary or the top business, it would be a very smart and simple thing to do.
Yeah, they actually used to have those kiosks. They had a kiosk for that down near the old St. George Hotel when it was still in place. I guess now that's the near the bookshop Santa Cruz. And they do have an electronic where to go and what to do as you walk through the Coffee Roasting Company. I don't know if that's paid for by the city or by the Coffee Roasting Company.
I think all the kiosks, which right now are being used to help little businesses make money, and have kind of been abandoned, like the Palomar Arcade, as far as being opportunities or bootstrap opportunities for small businesses that otherwise couldn't have business downtown. That was an idea that got the kiosks and that arcade started, and it's been abandoned because it's, quote, too much, end quote. But the kiosks should be for, I think, public service things.
I think it's a good idea, and you ran for city council several years ago.
Yeah, I even got some votes. Amazing.
Are you considering either a future run, or do you think that you were ever going to put together a group that is going to propose a number of alternative ideas like this, which I think is a great idea.
I've proposed these kinds of ideas in every opportunity and forum I can think of, including Free Radio Santa Cruz. And I will keep on doing it. You know, I love this city. I'm here for keeps, you know. Mm-hmm. But as far as running again goes, you know, my life teeters between the two extremes of homelessness and public service. And in between, it's a moment-by-moment or day-by-day struggle. I would do it again if the opportunity were here. I'm in much worse straits economically than I was when I ran before. So it's up to our, you know, the society at large and our community in particular. I might have to get a job as a host, who knows?
Have you learned anything about what we were discussing earlier, the proposal the city council has to privatize Scope Park, or Scribner Park, the park across from the town clock?
No, I haven't yet, Robert. I guess I'm glad that they didn't turn it into three entrances to an underground parking lot under the Ohlone burial grounds, but I haven't learned anything yet this morning. If I do, while you're still in the air, I'll give you a call.
Oh, great. Okay.
Thanks.
Sure.
So, see you.
All right. Thank you, Linda.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
So there you have it. The phone lines are open again. That was Lighthouse Linda LeMaster. Again, I would like to state that these nicknames given to these callers are my creation. They are in no way responsible for the labels that I heap upon them, and anyone complaining about their nickname can certainly come to me and denounce me in the roundest terms, and many have. The nicknames actually originated in the Street Shit Sheet, which is a homeless newsletter that I write, a newsletter about the civil rights of poor people on the streets and demonstrations and protests designed to increase the power and scope of people's rights who are poor and the services that poor people get. And it makes colorful reading to have those kinds of names. At least that's what I've found to be the case, and I think often they're apropos, but sometimes they're not, and that happens too. So you are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, and this is Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides. And the call-in number here, and we want you to call, as you know, is 427-3772, or 427-FRSC. So, I have my usual mass of clippings here, which I'm going through and sharing with you. I was going to talk to you about public defenders, and I guess I'll begin talking about that. Public defenders, I've always had a somewhat ambivalent, often critical relationship with public defenders. These are the attorneys assigned by the county and the state to defend you if you're charged with a misdemeanor or a felony. And many is the time when I've been involved in protests with people where they are charged with misdemeanors like trespass. It's a favorite misdemeanor where we're simply engaging in a free speech exercise to draw public attention to the fact that a shelter is closed or that a kitchen, for instance, promised to the free meal is not being provided, so instead we use one of the public kitchens at the Civic Center Auditorium to make a meal in a high-profile kind of publicity stunt that attempts to embarrass the city and publicize the issue of their noncompliance. We did that back in 1990. And then when we're arrested and taken to court, we are charged with usually trespass, which means they tell you to leave a piece of property and you don't, and then they prosecute you for it. You can face up to 6 months in jail or a $1,000 fine. And to defend you, you are appointed what's called a public defender. And this is usually well-intentioned individual, often a woman, occasionally a man, actually it's 50-50, I guess, whose first impulse is to encourage you to bargain away all your rights and take a plea, because that is the way, I guess, they can see the system works. Plead guilty to a lesser charge, or plead guilty for a suspended sentence, or plead guilty and take probation. And those of us doing protests, of course, are not interested in pleading guilty, usually. We're interested in having the state drop the charges, having the city rectify the injustice that the demonstration almost invariably a peaceful demonstration, has, I would say invariably, I've not been involved in a violent demonstration here, except when the police attacked us. I guess you'd call that violent. I mean, no police were injured, but they did haul off soup servers. And then there was a police riot on May 11th in 1994. But anyway, let's get back to this. The role of the public defender often seems to be to hurry people through the courts to a conclusion rather than to truly represent their interests as the defendants conceive their interests. Now, some of the problem has always been that public defenders as attorneys conceive of themselves, and indeed to some extent are, specialists in areas of the law. So they think they know better than the defendant the best thing to do, and in a certain sense they do. I mean, they have a wider and a deeper understanding of the legal intricacies of the law, which is frequently completely irrational and simply a mass of arcane and peculiar rules that it takes some time to master, although not as much time as you might think. There are some damn good cases that have been effectively made by people who have defended themselves, such as Ned von Falkenberg, who was with me, and he's defended himself at least 20 times in Lockheed trespass actions, and very complicated trials, and won every time. There's the case of Wanton Dave Jacobs, who's successfully defended himself. He's been found guilty, but on appeal, all 16 of his misdemeanors, if I'm not mistaken here, have been either dismissed or overturned or not filed. And this is in spite of the city's best and most expensive efforts to go after him for such things as criminally sitting at the town clock, criminally sitting on the sidewalk across from the Java House, trying to enter a city council meeting from which the police were barring him because they had mistaken him as being part of a demonstration. He attempted in a peaceful but forceful manner, simply symbolic manner, to make a citizen's arrest against Officer Lennon, and he was strong-armed and hustled off to jail and charged with any number of misdemeanors. All that he successfully defended himself on. And so you, in a certain sense, you don't need a public defender if you're willing to do the work and put in the time and have the interest in dealing with the law yourself. And in a certain sense, it gives you broader leeway, because judges frequently give people defending themselves somewhat more leeway than they give attorneys, who are supposed to be sort of part of a specialized club, a club that knows the rules and is supposed to very strictly adhere to those rules. But more about this after we catch our next caller here.
Hi there, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hello, Robert, this is John.
Hi there, John.
How's it going?
Not bad.
I thought I'd get in on the public defender discussion.
Please.
As regards people who are positioned as so-called mentally ill people here, and how the public defender system works.
I'd like to go ahead, please.
Right on. What it is the public defender, the county council, and the judge effectively collude with the psychiatrist and the staff workers at the local mental health unit to decide for anyone who's brought into the civil court proceedings under the Lantrum and Petras Short Act, which is the conservatorship hearings, or in the case of when a person held on in a mental health unit gets a writ of habeas corpus and goes to before one of the superior court judges, and they have a public defender then as well. The public defender then also will collude with the psychiatrist, the psychiatric staff, and the judge to do what's in the best interest, so as they call it, for the pitiful person trapped in that damned system.
Mm-hmm.
You understand what they mean by best interest of the person is to stick them in what they call the so-called least restrictive alternative place, which could be anywhere from maximum security at a Tascadero or Vacaville, or semi-maximum security imprisoning at Napa State Hospital, or Harbor Hills out on 7th Avenue, which is a locked facility, or it could be subacute residential treatment, as they call it, out of a privately owned facility here, which is a semi-locked facility, or it could be a residential care home, but it definitely won't be freedom. It will not be release from the system, if it, as is usually worked out in these damn really incredibly, I don't have a word to apply to them, you understand?
Oppressive, abusive?
Abusive, really, it's like a show trial, you understand? It's like they go through the formal, they go through the form of it, but the content of it is predetermined.
So let's for our audience kind of step back a moment and kind of refer more specifically to what actually is going on here. An individual is picked up by a police officer or committed by a doctor to a locked ward on a 72-hour hold under Section 5150 of the Welfare and Institutions Code.
Right.
And then after that period of time, what happens? Run us through that.
Well, during that time, they get an opportunity to have a hearing on whether or not they are not mentally, so-called mentally ill.
A danger to themselves, a danger to others, or,
right,
or gravely
danger,
disabled.
Right, as the language of the act is.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's you, you have effectively to prove that you're not a danger to yourself. They'll make their argument, and you'll have the patient's rights advocate from the Ombudsman's Advocate's Office here, which is a semi-independent autonomous office from the mental health system. You have a patient's rights advocate who will help you argue your case, and you need to prove that you're not a danger to yourself, meaning you're not out to kill yourself, you're not a danger to others, you're not out to kill anybody else, and that you're not gravely disabled, meaning you're able to provide for food, clothing, and shelter, but effectively, over in the criminal justice system and the municipal court system, they're satisfied if you're able to go to the shelter or sleep out in the woods and confine the soup kitchen on those three counts. But in the civil court, that doesn't count.
Yeah.
You have actually to prove that you have some actual resource and a friend or a family who's going to house you. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
It's not effectively enough in the civil courts to prove, or in the hearing, as we're talking about, to prove that you can just go to the shelter and so forth. That's actually depending on the administrative law judge who does the hearing. And the hearing is held inside the mental health unit. You have no right to refuse psychiatric treatment, effectively, which is to say you have the right to certain hearings after they've stuck you in there. So during those 3 days, you can demand a writ. You'll be put off several times. If you lose that hearing, you'll be bound over for like 14 days, I believe it is.
Now, by a writ, you mean
a writ of habeas corpus.
Which is somewhat different than any of these hearings you've spoken of.
Right. A writ of habeas corpus means that the mental health, the people who run the mental health unit, effectively the head psychiatrist, usually Dr. Gillette, has to show cause why they have a right to hold you, and it has to be done in the superior court systems, which is separate from the civil court system, but it works just the same there. You go in and the judge listens to the shrink, and the judge listens to you and the PD and the county council, and inevitably they start psychologizing about you and what's good for you and in your mental condition, considering what Dr. Gillette has said about you. You know, you really need this treatment. It's for your best interest. And it's all, you can be, you know, you haven't committed a crime, you haven't threatened anybody, and you're not accused of committing a crime. You're just, you're different. Your behavior has gotten a certain amount of attention from someone. Say the business community don't like you on the mall anymore, or you already got a label and you're in a residential care home and you've decided to leave. You don't want to live there anymore, and your case manager has gotten the cops pick you up and haul you in, or any number of other ways.
Or a family dispute.
Or a family dispute, right. Your parents that happens often with teenagers. The parents decide you need treatment. Well, we're going to anyway. It's a terrible story. Anyway, you effectively have no rights at all once you've got this psychiatric label. You've got the right to confess that you're mentally ill, which is one of the essential requirements for getting out of the damn thing. You know, as long as you say you're not mentally ill, you're resisting them and their program. So it has a lot of similarities to the Inquisitions when witches, people were accused of being witches, right? Mm-hmm. So they said, well, the person accused of being a witch would say, I'm not a witch. Mm-hmm. And they would say, well, we're going to put you through these series of tortures, and we'll see if you're a witch. See how if you float, then you must be a witch. If you drown, you're not, right? And so on. And you would think, well, okay, I'll confess I'm a witch, but when confessing that you're a witch, they don't let you go. It's the same in the mental health system, you know. If you don't confess you're mentally ill, they won't let you go, and if you do, they won't let you go.
So as I understand it then, the public defender, which of course is the initial point of departure we began talking about, doesn't initially have a role in the first hearing as to whether you're...
No, not then. It's later when a public defender has a role in the writ hearing, the writ of habeas corpus hearing, and in conservatorship hearings, when the system decides that you're too recalcitrant, you continue to resist, you won't stay in your boarding care home, you won't conform, you don't want to take your drugs, and any number of other reasons, then they'll have a conservatorship hearing in which they take away all of your. An exhaustive list of all the rights they can take away. They take away certain rights, principally the right to decide where you're going to live, the right to refuse psychiatric drugs, or in some cases the right, as is recently demonstrated, the right to refuse psychiatric treatment, or let's say the right to refuse shock treatment when an 80-some-year-old woman was dragged over to Monterey County and shocked 5 or 6 times.
Really? When did that happen?
2 or 3 months ago. We tried to mount a protest against it, and thanks to Jane Kaiser and a lot of her work another organization, I can't remember the name of the other organization, who got into the facility and talked to the woman, and raised such a protest about it, they got her out. But not until she'd already gotten a series of shock treatments. Anyway, there is a book titled Social Order and Mental Disorder, in which there's a study of the collusive aspects of the public defender in the civil court proceedings.
You know who the author of this book is, John?
The author is Andrew Scull, or Schull, S-C-U-L-L. And here's an example. He gives in this book, he gives an example of a PD who comes in and wants to assert the various civil liberties issues involved in all of these civil commitments and protective custodies aspects of the cases, so this particular PD, here's the reading. He persuaded a number of his conservative clients, meaning people ready to be conserved, to ask for jury trials, which is your right. You know, you don't have to go in there and just face the judge. You can demand a jury trial. And when people demand jury trials, it turns out that the system does everything in the power to not have a jury trial, because most of the time we win our jury trials, even with the collusive efforts of the public defender, we manage to win those. So he gets them to demand jury trials, thus tying up departments I gotta put on my glasses here. Excuse me, Robert.
Sure.
Thanks for bearing with me.
No, I think it's important information.
Thus tying up departments 2 or 3 days on end, so when we demand jury trials, that costs them money. Because he also spent hours studying and arguing for on habeas corpus hearings. He was really a concerned person, committing what was probably the most egregious organizational faux pas, talking at length to clientele, which is to say, that's the worst thing they do, is talk to us about what's going on, right? Unlike his predecessors, and the name Mr. Simmons did not modify his behavior over time, let alone cease and desist. After a few weeks, the judge became angry. Bill Simmons was fired from his job after about 3 months. When I asked another public defender why, he replied, "Oh, that guy, because he was stupid," which is to say, he really fought for the people's rights. So this skull continues, "As this example suggests, while the formal requirements of the law do, to a limited extent, constrain decision-making, they are far from determining outcomes. For instance, long-term commitment based on the need for care and treatment, the standard overturned by Lantrum Petras Short, has been restored through the use of conservatorships," which is to say the Lantrum Petras Short Act was supposed to reduce those things, but they've patently resolved or subverted the law to their own uses, and it's back to where it was before the law was ever passed.
Well, what recommendation do you have for an individual who, let's say, either doesn't feel his public defender or a public defender is going to help him because of your sense or his sense that there's just likely to be this kind of collusion, or just simply wants advice about legal rights if this person is currently being either held in an institution or is afraid of that thing happening to her?
What do I recommend?
Yeah, who can they call? What can they do?
Who can they call?
Any groups locally you suggest?
Any groups. Well, they could call me.
Okay. Would you like to give out your number on the air?
427-2171.
427-2171, and your name is?
John Stewart.
John Stewart.
Right.
And John, are you working with an organization?
There's more or less a prospective organization called Madhouse Exit.
Madhouse Exit. So
right. But
427-2171 to reach Madhouse Exit.
Right. Okay. There's also Jane Kaiser at. I know she's with Psychiatric Inmates Rights Collective. And her number is 475-7904. 475-7904. Right. The only until we have this is the Psychiatric Inmates Liberation Movement. We're out to abolish the mental health system. We're not out to reform it. We're not out. We don't cooperate with it. We don't collaborate with it. We don't accept money from it. We don't want to have anything to do with it. We don't talk their language. You understand? And I myself, I don't do advocacy for people, which is to say, I don't go in and listen to their stories and then advocate for them in their language, because too often people want me to call themselves schizophrenics or manic depressives, and I refuse to use that language about myself or anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't choose to do advocacy work, but other people do, and refer them
to those people.
I don't anymore give them a reference. Let them find them on their own, if you understand.
But what kind of help would you be interested in providing? What kind of information can they get?
I can only talk from my own direct experience with the system, and I've thought about this a lot. I don't really have a series of do's and don'ts. I can portray a set of circumstances in which taking certain actions will result in certain consequences, you know, and it's such a problematic situation. You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't inside of that damn thing. Mm-hmm. If you assert your rights to extreme, you can end up tied down and shot in the butt with Prolixin, and you know.
At least you're willing to talk to people about what you sense their options are.
Right. I don't have any do's or don'ts. I don't think there are any do's and don'ts. It's like, you give someone a set of do's and don'ts and they get stuck on them, they can end up in terrible trouble. Whereas if I just try to give them a sense of what they face when they're taken in like that and locked away, you know, it's like it's really terrible that you effectively have no right to be. You can't be who you are the way you are because they've decided you're mentally ill.
Now,
so everything you say and do is an evidence of some kind of symptom of mental illness, so-called.
So how long have you been living in Santa Cruz area, John?
I've been here since 76.
Now, you probably had seen numerous cases involving public defenders here.
Yeah, we used to go every Friday. They're held every Friday here in Santa Cruz. Jane Kaiser and I used to go every Friday. We've seen a lot of them.
We've tried
to get people out on writs, tried to get people out on everything. The basic thing with me is this. I'm not working with the people in the system, you know, the psychiatric inmates. The people held inside against their will, I call inmates. They're held prisoner against their will. They're psychiatric inmates. It's like the only way people are ever going to get out of there is to get the system out of their head, you know, to get the system out of them. And it's like, as long as you're talking that language, it's problematic whether or not you'll ever get out. It's like a swinging door. Also, it's like, you have to learn to live in two worlds. This is getting off the initial subject.
Let's go back to public defenders. Now, your experience of public defenders over the last two decades, do you have any specific anecdotes you'd like to tell us, or do you have any...
Well, yeah, there's a recent one. A woman decided...
Before I forget, let me interrupt you one more time.
Yeah.
If individuals want to go to court or to one of these hearings, which is held in the hospital...
They're usually Friday at 1, they can ask where the conservator hearings are.
So we're talking about the hearings in court, like the habeas corpus or conservator hearings?
No, not the habeas corpus. They're randomly, depending on when the writ was filed.
Right, so what kind of hearing are we talking about?
We're talking about the conservatorship hearings.
So conservatorship hearings usually happen on Friday afternoon about 1:30?
At 1:30 in the civil court, so you can ask like in the...
That's the 701 Ocean Street, I believe.
Right. You can ask in the court office. What's the name of that place?
Probably the court clerk.
Yeah, where the civil court hearings are.
Right, probably his department.
Server hearings, right.
7 or 8 or 4 or 5.
Right.
So people can just walk into these hearings and they can serve, huh?
Yeah, if you think, an interesting aspect of this is confidentiality. You know, you go to a psychiatrist, you tell them all your troubles.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like... You think this is all in confidence, this guy, this man, almost inevitably a white male, is not going to tell anybody this stuff, but guess what? If it push comes to shove and you decide you don't want that psychiatric treatment anymore, and they decide to conserve you, and you go to court, everything you've ever told this guy is up for public grab. Everything.
Let me. That's not true with an attorney-client relationship, but apparently it is true in spite of a doctor-patient relationship.
Right.
Let me ask you again about your experiences with public defenders here in Santa Cruz over the last couple decades, and feel free to name names if you'd like.
Well, I don't actually have any names. It's been like up and down. Most of the time, to give the public defender's office some slack, they're an underpaid, overworked, understaffed group of people, you understand? And probably the least attractive of all parts of the law they're entangled with is this part of it, the mental health civil commitment laws. So giving them that, but anyway, they should be better understood. They're as propagandized and indoctrinated as anybody else in this society to believe that psychiatry is science. It's bullshit, though. It's false science based on corrupt values, utterly corrupt. But it's a long argument to prove that to people, you know? The public defenders here, the most recent one was my friend Jane told me about it, so I went over, and the way it worked was the psychiatrist, the public defender, the county council all got together, and during a series of meetings with the person who was challenging their conservatorship, they talked this person into going to Harbor Hills instead of getting out, because effectively they threatened her. They threatened her with no support from of any kind, meaning that she would have to hit the streets effectively. Mm-hmm. She couldn't face living on the streets, so she was faced with the alternative of being turned away from the shelters, living on the streets with no other kind of support. So she chose Harbor Hills. So it wasn't like the public defender could have fought for her to have the right to social workers finding her a place to live. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
But instead of that, he colluded with the rest of them to get her stuck in Harbor Hills, where she'll work her way out, hopefully, over a period of, 6 months to eternity, if ever, mm-hmm. you know, and be on the regime of psychiatric drugs 3 times a day and the worst food you can imagine and just utter chaos, you know, and future potential irremediable brain damage from the psychiatric drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's an example, the most recent example. Jane, if she were around, she could tell you any number of cases.
You might
want
to give Jane a call and ask her if she wants to call in. While we're on the air here, because the subject will continue for another 45 minutes talking about...
Okay, I'll do that. And I'll let it go for now. And thanks for your time, Robert.
Well, listen, I thank you, John, and I'll encourage our audience to give a call to you, Madhouse Exit, at 427-2171, or to Jane Kaiser at the Psychiatric Inmates Rights Collective.
Right, but I don't want people calling up and arguing the merits of the so-called mental illness, you understand?
Right.
I don't want to argue with them on someone...
So if you're interested in getting information about your rights, maybe, John, you could be...
Well, if someone's actually in some circumstance where my experience with the system might be of help, that's what I would listen to. I don't want to argue about whether or not there's mental illness or whether or not psychiatry is good for you.
Gotcha.
Or any of that stuff.
And your number, again, is 427-2171.
Right.
And that of PIRC, Psychiatric Inmates Rights Collective, is... 475-79